The Imezeren, known by the largest portion of the world as the Berbers, are the OGs of North and Sub-Saharan Africa. Their existence traced back to 20,000 years ago, but let's address the elephant in the room first. The ongoing debate about what to call them, as I just referred to that ethnic group using two different denominations in a single sentence. So, are they Berbers? Are they Imezeren? What's the tea? For centuries, Arab and Andalusian historians have had people believing in a rather creative and amusing tale about the origin of the word Berber. Scholars like the Andalusian Ibn Khaldun in the 14th century, the Iraqi al-Kilbi in the 11th century, and the Iranian al-Tabari in the 8th century, and many others truly, claimed that thousands of years ago, a Yemeni king named Ifriqus bin Qais bin Saif, part of the Yemeni mythology and known as one of the Tula kings, ventured across the seas to conquer the mysterious lands of present-day North Africa. As the story goes, he brought along factions of the Yemeni Himyar tribes, which later would have formed the Amazigh branches of the Ktema and Sinhaja tribes. Ifriqus supposedly built villages and cities, but when he encountered the local tribes of North Africa, known as the Libyans, he was so taken aback by the sound of their language that he just screamed, "What a Berber is yours!" By this, he was comparing their speech to the cries of a confused lion, expressing just how unintelligible their dialects were to him. The word Berbera was then picked up by other civilizations encountering the Libyans, eventually morphing into the word Berber. Of course, we now know that there's little historical evidence to back this story up. It's more of a very imaginative bedtime tale than a factual account. So, what do we know for a fact? The word Berber has Greek roots. It stems from the term barabaroi, which the Romans, after centuries of close interaction with the Imezeren, as we'll explore hopefully in a forthcoming episode, adapted and transformed into barbari. Interestingly enough, this term wasn't initially coined exclusively for the inhabitants of North Africa, the Imezeren tribes, with whom the Romans and Greeks interacted in ancient times. Instead, in both Latin and Greek, it had a double use. One, it could designate anyone who didn't speak either Latin or Greek. And two, it was also used to label non-Phoenician residents of the Carthaginian state as foreigners, regardless of their origin. On the other hand now, the so-called Berbers or foreigners have a very distinct perception of themselves, a perception that is reflected in their identities and in the way they decided to refer to themselves. They call themselves Imezeren, but the meaning of this word has an underlining tension to it. There is historical evidence that shows that the word Emezir derives from an ancient Egyptian term that expresses the idea of a foreigner. And I think we can confidently speak for all the Emezir communities when we say that since ancient times they have endured numerous foreign invasions with groups of people entering and leaving North Africa, settling on their lands, engaging in intensive trade, exploiting the land, etc., etc., from the Phoenicians to the Romans to Arabs to Europeans and beyond. And in the face of adversity, they chose to refer to themselves as kind of like the original gangsters, the true authentic inhabitants of North Africa, in contrast with everyone else that was coming and leaving all the time. Which is why a common translation of the word Emezir is freemen, the free people, the free humans. Another interesting translation is that of the Tuareg tribes who refer to themselves as the noblemen, the noble women. So the essence of the word Berber is essentially to be an outsider, but why would you ever label someone as an outsider when that person has been inhabiting a place since time immemorial to the extent that their substantial identity bled into those that attempted to colonize them? How does that make sense? It doesn't. It simply doesn't. Over time, the term Berber evolved and was adapted by the Arabs to describe these native populations, which were historically referred to in many ways as Libyans, Afri, Getul, Numides, and so on and so forth. It is hardly a secret to anyone. The core of Moroccan identity is deeply rooted in the Imazighan heritage that is present in us in Morocco and also throughout North Africa. We know that the Imazighan are among the oldest groups to have settled on the fertile plains, vast plateaus, arid dunes, and rocky mountains of North Africa. This naturally raises an existential question. Where did this resilient mosaic of ancestral peoples come from? A group that neither Roman rule, Arab conquests, Ottoman ambitions, nor European colonialism could fully diminish. Who are the Imazighan? On this episode of the podcast, we're going to try to explore a couple, just a couple, answers that were given to this question by historical evidence historians over the centuries, starting with the theory of Gabriel Comps. Now, Gabriel Comps is a well-known archaeologist and scholar who suggested that the Imazighan, the Imazighan people, are descended from early Mediterranean groups that originally came from the Near East around 8,000 years ago. The Near East refers to regions like modern-day Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and the Levant, specifically the Levant. These ancient groups started moving westward, so towards the west, during that time. As they migrated, they traveled through the landscapes of North Africa, they crossed the Algerian Tell Mountains, and they settled in the famous Atlas Mountains of Morocco. Over time, they also spread into the large, expansive southern Sahara Desert, establishing themselves throughout the region. And even though we're about to contradict this theory, why is it so important? Well, because Comps' theory challenges earlier ideas from the colonial era that incorrectly connected the Imazighan to Europeans or ancient civilizations such as the Persians or the people from Canaan. Instead, he suggests that the Imazighan have a closer link, a closer ancestry to early Mediterranean peoples or populations who played a significant role in shaping the diversity in North Africa. But because it's always interesting to see the evolution of the historical narrative and the historical evidence, let's actually take a closer look on those ancient theories. Ancient historians have offered their perspectives on the origins of the Imazighan people as well. Procopius, a Byzantine historian of the 6th century, and Flavius Josephus, a Romano-Jewish historian from the 1st century, linked the Imazighan people to biblical stories, suggesting that they were the descendants of the people from Canaan who were expelled by Joshua. Now, according to this narrative or account, the people from Canaan fled from Palestine to Egypt and then settled in Libya, a historical region in North Africa stretching from the Nile Delta to the Maghreb. Now, this narrative used to hold a lot of credibility because Flavius Josephus himself wrote extensively about Jewish history and the Roman Empire. His works, till this day, provide significant and extremely important evidence on the history of ancient Near East. Similarly, Sallust, a Roman historian and politician of the 1st century before Christ, proposed an Asian origin of the Imazighan. He traced their ancestry back to the Medes, Persians, and Armenians who migrated into Africa after the death of Hercules in Spain. These migrants would have interacted, intermingled with local populations and given rise essentially to new ethnic groups like the Numid and the Moorishes. Sallust, on his end, was known for his historical writings that provided insight into Roman politics and their military campaigns in North Africa and beyond. But as we can see already, these historical interpretations vary a lot, and understandably so, given how complex it is to understand ancient migrations and cultural interactions. Procopius and Josephus' biblical link kind of offer a narrative that is rooted in religious texts and migrations across the Mediterranean. In contrast, Sallust's account places the Imazighan within a broader Mediterranean context. Now, despite the lack of early written records from the Imazighen themselves, their interactions with major ancient civilizations are very well documented. This historical hole or absence or emptiness is largely compensated by the historical evidence, the historical material that was provided by their contemporaries, whom they've had a significant impact on. The Imazighen, known as Libyans or Lebu in ancient Egyptian texts, were esteemed for their formidable, amazing, extraordinary military skills, often serving as mercenaries. This reputation extended throughout the Mediterranean and beyond. In Egyptian history, the Imazighen had a significant impact, challenged famous pharaohs like Merneptah and Ramses III. Merneptah, who was the 13th son of the great Ramses II, and Ramses III, the powerful second ruler of the 20th dynasty, both had to deal with invasions from the Imazighen. These pharaohs made sure to document their encounters with the Imazighen in their official records, not just detailing the battles, but also showing how the Imazighen influenced Egypt's foreign policy. For Merneptah, it was a matter of defending Egypt from these very skilled warriors. Ramses III, on the other hand, faced a series of invasions that threatened the stability of his reign. The records from these times give us a vivid picture of the conflicts and portrays the Imazighen as not only very fierce opponents, but also as a strategic force that Egypt had to deal with. According to the evidence, the Imazighen's actions forced the pharaohs essentially to adapt their strategies and their policies. They weren't just basic military clashes, they were very pivotal and critical moments that shaped the course of Egyptian history. The influence of the Imazighen in Egypt extended further with the establishment of the 22nd dynasty under Shoshenq I. Now, King Shoshenq I was a direct descendant of a Libyan chieftain, marking a significant period of integration and cultural exchange between Imazighen and Egyptians during the early first millennium BCE before the Christ. Beyond Egypt, Herodotus, the esteemed Greek historian that is often called the father of history, provided an amazing insight into Imazighen culture or Amazigh culture during the 5th century BCE. He depicted them as nomadic peoples with distinct dietary habits and religious rituals heavily influenced by Egyptian customs. These exchanges weren't solely confined to Egypt, but they extended across the larger, broader Mediterranean region, touching lands like Sicily, Sardinia, Malta, and southern Spain. Plus, the Imazighen's multifaceted, diverse interactions with neighboring civilizations are underscored by the writings of Procopius, who is a Byzantine historian from the 6th century. Procopius recounts the dynamic role the Imazighen had in North African geopolitics and sheds light on their enduring impact on regional history. The narratives that is depicted shows the Imazighen in a light of adaptable and resilient people. People that were able to manage to forge lasting connections that contributed to their own cultural identity and that influenced the broader, larger Mediterranean world. The language of the Imazighen people, also known as Temezigt, is classified within the Afroasiatic language family, a family that also includes Egyptian language, the Semitic languages, Chadic, Omotic, etc. This quite vast linguistic family spans from North Africa all the way across the Horn of Africa into parts of the Middle East. Let's bring back Gabriel Kempes for a second, who, again, let me remind you, is a prominent scholar, he's an archaeologist, and he suggested that the Imazighen's ancestors were likely originating from the Near East, regions like present-day Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and the Levant. His hypothesis shows or suggests more a complex network of migrations, of interactions that shaped the linguistic landscape of the Imazighen over thousands and thousands of years. However, we have on the other hand another hypothesis that kind of contradicts Gabriel Comps's. It is the hypothesis of Christopher Eret. He essentially presents a very interesting alternative that has conquered the minds of many historians that really tried to answer the question of where do the Imazighen people come from? Now, little presentation, Eret is a respected historian. He's also a linguist, and he argues that people that speak Afroasiatic languages, so the family we mentioned earlier, are likely originating from Ethiopia and Eritrea. According to his research, these languages emerged approximately 20,000 years ago. He also denotes a significant diversification of those languages by 13,000 BCE, so before Christ. This timeline marks a crucial period in human prehistory, a timeline that is characterized by the spread of language and the spread of culture across ancient African societies. The hypothesis of Eret challenges Comps's that we just saw, suggesting a deeper root for the Afroasiatic languages in East Africa rather than the Near East. While Comps' perspective really, you know, allows us to understand more about the migration the Imazighen people could have done, Eret's theory, on the other hand, really shows that the Imazighen people likely are more rooted in the African continent than we thought. On the other hand, archaeological discoveries from North Africa and also Europe uncovered really deep connections during two very significant and very important time periods of human history. The first one is the last glacial maximum, and the second one is the early Holocene. Let us take each one by the horns separately. The last glacial maximum occurred approximately 20,000 years ago, marking the peak of the Ice Age, when enormous, gigantic ice sheets pretty much covered the majority of the surface of the Earth, and sea levels were significantly lower than they are today. This geographical setting makes it easier for humans to migrate across what is now known as the Strait of Jebel Tariq, so the Strait of Gibraltar, I think that's how you pronounce it in English. Those migrations allowed for a link to be created between the Iberian Peninsula, so modern-day Spain and Portugal, for those that didn't know, with North Africa. These migrations brought with them a diverse, you know, range of artifacts, cultural artifacts, such as obsidian tools that are valued for being very sharp and useful, dolmens as well, dolmens which were massive, massive stones. And these artifacts that we were able to find also included decorated pottery. In regions like Algeria, Tunisia, and the mountains of the Rif in Maghrib, so in Morocco, archaeologists were able to find evidence of European influence, suggesting that populations from Europe likely passed through the Iberian Peninsula, leaving a lasting impact on societal practices. But what's important about this archaeological record is that it sheds light on the ability of people, ancient societies, to move and adapt and be resilient in the face of the adversity that comes with periods of climatic and environmental change. They were able to navigate through the currents of climate change and adapt to shifts in their natural surroundings, forging connections and exchanging knowledge across very broad distances. And by knowledge, we mean technologies. Now let's see what the DNA says. Yes, let's talk genetics. The genetic and physical diversity among the Imazighen is quite interesting because it shows how much they moved, essentially, the migrations and the interactions they were involved in. While most of the Imazighen have Mediterranean features, there's a twist, because among them you'll find people with striking blonde or red hair, and eyes that are as blue as the sky, or as green as the forest, or as the Mediterranean itself, you could say. These particular traits are a result of centuries of, like I said, mixing and mingling with various groups from Northern Europe, Northern Europeans, to Sub-Saharan Africans. The professor Lucotte partially provided an answer to the why, and again, we have to look into the genetic studies. Now, when conducting these studies, we tend to use a tool that is very useful, very precise, and that is called the haplotypes or haplotype. Basically, the haplotypes are, how can I explain this in very simple words? They're groups of genes that hang out together, like they stick together through centuries and centuries and thousands of years, right? And that are inherited from a single parent. So you can trace back the single parent when you see and when you spot and identify a certain haplotype in a DNA specimen that you're studying. And what Lucotte's team uncovered is we were able to find haplotypes from Mediterranean, Near Eastern, and Sub-Saharan African populations. So it's very diverse genetic makeup. Now sure, because of all these different interactions they've had with different groups, different ethnic groups of people, the Imazighen have a very cohesive ethnic identity that is their own and that has remained extremely remarkably strong. When you narrow the scale to one tribe, you see that the unity is rooted in a shared language, in cultural practices, in religious beliefs that changed over time a lot, with myths and legends and cults that transcend completely tribal divisions. Historically, organized into tribes and confederations, each tribe with unique customs and their own governing structures, the Imazighen society is the example of, you know, the ability to preserve and protect a very distinct identity. An identity that was repeatedly put through the ringer and put to the test of time, of conquest, of human ambition, of human hunger for power, and of adversity. One of the most interesting thing about the Imazighen tribes and people is how enduring their spirit is. Truly, truly, throughout history, Imazighen communities have strongly and steadfastly resisted external dominance. They courageously opposed mighty empires like the Romans, the Byzantines, the Arabs, even though they struggled with that last one, who sought control over their lands. Later in the 7th century, like I said, they faced the Arab invasions that swept across North Africa and essentially transformed the entire land forever. The Arab conquest in the 7th century brought significant life-changing changes to the region. Led by Muslim armies, these conquests aimed to spread Islam, but it also was to establish Arab rule, let's face it. The Imazighen, however, fiercely defended their territories and their way of life continuously for centuries. Among the most legendary, notable figures of resistance was Dihia, the Dihia, also known as Kahina, a formidable, great Imazighen queen of the Aurès region in present-day Algeria. She rallied her people, her own people, against the Arab invaders. And she essentially became a symbol of Imazighen defiance and their struggle for independence. Her leadership and the efforts of resistance she displayed continuously till she was eventually defeated shows how much the Imazighen people have a deep-rooted, deep-rooted commitment to their cultural heritage and autonomy. I need you to realize this. Centuries of preserving a cultural DNA, a cultural heritage that was passed on to us Moroccans today, and without which we would genuinely not be what we are today, as have the vibrant culture that we have today, have the integrity that we have today. But let's broaden the picture to other regions, other landscapes of North Africa, where the Imazighen communities continue to play a vital role, right? Not only just cultural, but also political, depending on where you are. Countries like Morocco, right? Algeria, Tunisia, Libya, and Mali, they have a significant Imazighen population. In recent years, there has been, you know, a resurgence of Imazighen identity. In Morocco, for example, after the episode of the Arab Springs in 2011, the constitution was modified, Article 5, to include Amazigh dialects in the list of national languages. But as a result of this dynamic that had the Imazighen people struggle for so long, being ostracized for so long, isolated for so long from the central power, the Imazighen in Morocco have been marginalized by the system and by the way the central power operates now. In today's day and age, and especially after this episode, now that you know everything that made the Imazighen and how much Amazigh blood Moroccans have, all Moroccans truly, when we study the Imazighen in Morocco and we recognize them as a distinct social group, it's not about dividing the country. It shouldn't be perceived as a threat to national unity, because it's not. It's actually about making sure that everyone feels included and understood. And what do I mean by that, right? When you live in big cities in Morocco, you probably don't feel like there's a separation to be made. There are only Moroccans, right? But the truth is different. The truth is when you go to the Atlas Mountains, for example, on top of my head, you see people, Moroccans, fellow Moroccans, that have a much stronger attachment, historical, spiritual, cultural attachment to our collective Amazigh roots. It is their way of life. It is their daily life. It is the language they speak. It is the traditions, the practices they have every single day, their lifestyle. It is ingrained in them. Not all Moroccans' life look the same. And by focusing on their specific situation, we can better address issues like economic challenges, social inequality, the preservation of the Imazighen culture, which they are the mirrors of. They literally carry it. In a world where most Moroccans, right, Moroccans that live in urban cities have, I'm not saying all of them, but a big majority kind of have lost sight of their roots, of their origin story. These communities carry on that heritage, keep it alive. So when we refer to some Moroccans as Imazighen and we say that they need effective policies, specific policies, it just helps us create, like I said, effective policies that cater best to their needs, that promote fairness, that improve their quality of life. Because it is so dystopian and paradoxical that the Moroccans that have the strongest attachment to their Amazigh roots are the ones that are struggling to make it in their own land. Paradoxically, again, despite Morocco being an Amazigh land to the core, those who have been able to preserve this heritage most vividly are today the ones that face the greatest struggles. So when we look at the Imazighen separately, we're not creating a separation. You are just putting yourself in a disposition that allows you to best address the unique challenges that are faced by Moroccans that are most attached to their Imazighen roots and whom we will refer to as the Imazighen. You're showing commitment to inclusivity in Morocco and social justice as well. It's only a step forward to a united Morocco. And that is the end of the episode. I hope you liked it. It was packed with a lot of information. I hope I didn't bore you out. If you liked it, please make sure to, you know, message me on Instagram, Aya Shukri, depending on how you pronounce it. Leave a 5-star review if you liked the podcast, if you enjoyed the episodes. I'm going to try to be much more regular. I know I always say this, but these episodes take a while to research. By the way, the resources will be in the description below. All of them, I used many, so you can, you know, go look up the pages that I read to find the informations, so you can back check it. And I will also add additional links to articles if you want to, you know, dig deeper into the subject, because it is a really important one. I have been your host, Aya, in your favorite podcast about Moroccan history, Land of Mankind, and I will see you in an upcoming episode. Thank you so much for listening.